if you're George W. Bush, or you're the generals, you're anybody who wants the Republican Party back, if you want a shot at trying to build something better or functioning as a governing body, you better hope Trump loses. And you know what, George? You know what we know? We know they do want Trump to lose.
They do, but they won't
do anything about it, though.
Correct. They all want Trump to lose. Even people at the RNC want Trump to lose.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All. To Sarah, I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark. And because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain the legal news to me. Since we're a little slow this week on Trump's legal cases, I think, George, we should talk a little politics and then we can get to a little legal news and some, listener questions. But okay. I wanted to
ask, is there anything political going on out there?
Well, it's kind of there's kind of a lot of political news this week. In fact, so much news that we had to tape this on Saturday because we were both so busy this week with all the other stuff. So I just, this is why I look like this. I mowed the lawn, came inside, taping a pod. It's the life. It's the life we choose. Okay, so I wanted to ask you before.
Oh, by the way, you see my t-shirt?
Love your neighbor, Christian. Not a storm I'm a love your neighbor, Christian.
And not a storm
the capital kind. It's actually not that easy to read when you hold it up like that, but I got it.
But then I have to stand up like that. Here.
Where did you get that shirt?
I know some people who are involved with evangelicals for Harris, and one of them sent picture of it to me, or somebody was wearing a picture of it, and a picture of somebody wearing the shirt, and I said, where can I get one? And I ordered one. It's a great shirt. I'm Catholic, not evangelical, but I feel, I think that counts.
I think that all of us are just trying to figure out how to be better people all the time. And also to keep people who storm the Capitol or encourage others to storm the Capitol out of the White House.
Storming Capitol is bad.
Bad. I've heard that it's bad. Yeah.
Yes, it's bad. I've checked.
Speaking of things that are bad.
Yes.
Have you heard of this guy, Mark Robinson?
Apparently Donald Trump hasn't.
Never heard of the guy.
Never heard of him. Never heard of him. Yeah. No.
Mark Robinson, gubernatorial candidate
in
North Carolina?
I don't know how we can really discuss him without really bleeping basically everything for the next 15 minutes.
This is a family show.
This is a family show. And somebody online did something really clever, and Barry knows about, our producer Barry knows about AI voices. You can feed apparently people's voices into some website, and then you can then have that website generate anything and it sounds like that person. Well, anyway, they had famous historical statesman reading some of the posts that Mark Robinson put on this porn website. And it's quite something. CNN couldn't even tell its audience how bad some of this stuff was. It's pretty really horrific. I mean, I don't care what people look at, but you gotta be a little nuts to put this stuff in your own name. And to spend the time to, it's just really,
it is true. We've spent now an inordinate amount of time having to discuss, because of the Republican candidates, both for governor of North Carolina as well as president of the United States, the word porn, because one was involved in a fraud case with a porn and that involved a porn actress. And then a big part of the scandal of Mark Robinson is not at all the porn part of it. In fact, in neither of these cases is the porn part relevant, other than it was a bridge into, in Trump's case, fraud and election interference. And in Mark Robinson's case, he was posting on this chat board a number of things that are alarming. He called himself a black Nazi.
Black Nazi thing is quite something. I don't know if Goebbels and Hitler and Himmler and all those people would have approved.
I think that there's a bit of a misunderstanding that this gentleman has about who
About the
some of
nature of
these.
Nazism?
It
Yeah.
might be. And I think his confusion is further exacerbated or illuminated by the fact that he also said on this website that he would like to own slaves. We should bring slavery back. Also think he would not think this is a good idea if he thought about it for 5 seconds.
Yeah, no.
And then
Yeah, all of these things seem like not something, they seem politically inexpedient.
they do seem politically
Yeah,
inexpedient.
I would think.
You know what's interesting to me, though, about the Mark Robinson story
Yeah.
is that with these new revelations, we've learned, I guess, like new salacious specifics, but they're not that important, or they are new information in the specific, but they are not new information in terms of us understanding how to think about Mark Robinson. And so Donald Trump has been calling Mark Robinson Martin Luther King times two.
This is Martin Luther King on steroids. Okay, now I told that to Mark. I said, I think you're better than Martin Luther King. I think you are Martin Luther King times two.
Like, he's better than Martin Luther King. He's a great fighter for North Carolina. Trump loves him. But he was already a Holocaust denier.
He was already a Holocaust denier. He's already, I mean, he has already said, outrageous things about women and abortion and all sorts of stuff. And this, at least he's kind of, I mean, the trans porn aspect of it, at least he's showing kind of an open-mindedness that he doesn't really show, hasn't really shown thus far, I guess,
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
argue.
Like, it's not,
I think,
well,
maybe.
nobody cares. Like if he like whatever he watches, whatever. But he was talking specifically about some affinity for transgender pornography, and
Pornography, right.
and
And then
that
he was
is.
talking about some weird activities with his sister-in-law. And one of her,
It's too
and
much.
we're
It's
not
too
going to
much.
go
It's
there.
too much.
Too much. Okay.
I only care about the
Right.
things that are relevant to the things that he says politically,
That's
right? So
true.
it doesn't matter to me about any of the other stuff. What
Well,
matters.
I mean, those posts do show a degree of, I think they have some misogynistic aspects to them, which I think is, I mean, I think it's reflective of some of the things that he has said, and in that sense could be deemed relevant. I mean, I'd have to go back and review them, but I really don't want to review the posts.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah.
I haven't got. I've mainly like the transgender stuff matters to me only insofar as he has called transgender children demonic. And similarly, he
Oh, I
actually at one
missed that
point,
one.
yeah. Well,
Thankfully.
but so this is relevant to the policies that he believes in, the things he says he espouses. And abortion is a similar one where he has been very extreme in his abortion beliefs while having. It was disclosed that ultimately that he and his wife, he paid for an abortion with his wife. And so I think that it is, it's sort of the hypocrisy and the way that he demonizes certain groups that he is happy to sort of exploit for his own
He's just a, I mean,
kink, but.
I think he's a bad dude. I mean, I hate to reach that conclusion about anyone, but I think
Yeah.
he's a bad dude. Not necessarily because he has unusual or interesting tastes in vice, but I think overall he's a bad dude. I don't think he's I think he may be a bad dude.
Yeah, I remember him calling the survivors of the violence at Marjory Stoneman, those kids, he called them prostitutes.
Yeah, and in that sense, I guess we haven't learned anything. He was already a bad dude. But
That's right.
I have to wonder just sort of, I mean, this is just sort of an instinct about politics, is I wonder if there's anything worse that's going to come out. Because sometimes, you don't usually dump the worst oppo on somebody this far in advance, although they did seem to, it may have been Republicans dumped this oppo because they wanted, there was the deadline of Thursday night this week, under North Carolina law, under which that was the deadline for swapping out a candidate. And, you know, he refused to get out. And the state Republican Party, therefore, had no mechanism by which to replace him before the deadline. And so he's going to be there. And it'll be interesting, too. I mean, I'm interested in your thoughts as the political person here, how this affects the election. I mean, he's denying that any of this is real, even though one of the things you know about the internet is, yes, lots of things can be faked on the internet, but you cannot fake things back in time. Okay, because this stuff has been there for years, and you could show that it has been there for years. And so, you know, there is no back to the future DeLorean that allows you on the internet to reverse time and create something fake that was done by somebody long before they ran for public office. So it doesn't really work. And he used his own name, and he used it the same ID in multiple email and multiple locations. But, you know, I mean, the MAGA types are going to do the thing where, oh, this is all just the fake media and the liberals have created this fake stuff. But I wonder, though, I mean, I guess the way it would negatively affect would be demoralizing at least some Republican voters who are willing to vote for Trump, and they think, oh, I can't anymore, or they're just sort of depressed and they stay home. It can't help, I guess. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I certainly think Mark Robinson is going to lose the election. Now, I did a bunch of focus groups. I did some focus groups with North Carolina voters about Mark Robinson, actually before this next batch of things came out. And it was just sort of when they had the information from his primary, because he ran against sort of like a Joe Normie Republican and blew him out in the Republican primary, right? They wanted this guy. However, this sort of like centerish right voters in the state, people who know about Mark Robinson, there was this group of, I remember very distinctly, this group of Trump voters that we were talking to who thought Mark Robinson was anti-Semitic. They knew all about the Holocaust denial. They knew that he was terrible to, one woman was talking about, I just went back and revisited this, terrible to LGBTQ people. She even used the Q. But these people were all voting for Donald Trump. Like they distinguish. And so here's my biggest worry about some of these really insane candidates that Donald Trump has drawn into the party is that, because Carrie, this is happening in Arizona too, where Carrie Lake is doing much worse than Donald Trump in polls.
Yeah, they make Trump look normal.
That is my fear, is that Trump looks kind of like the regular, normal, not normal politician, but like, oh no, this guy's normal and
which
the rest
of
these guys are bonkers.
Which is kind of amazing, because it's really not true. I mean, say what you will about Mark Robinson, but he's not an adjudicated rapist. He's not, you know, he never launched an insurrection against the Constitution. He, you know, doesn't have a trail of 24 women plus who he, you know, engaged in inappropriate behavior with, including sexual assault. And, you know, it's sort of like the Loomer thing. It's like, why, you know, people are like, all these Republicans, including actually Tom Tillis. Tom Tillis, actually, that he tweeted about Robinson. But a lot of Republicans are saying, you got to stay away from Loomer. It's terrible, Mr. President. It's awful. Loomer's like, well, but what's the difference between Laura Loomer and Donald Trump? I mean, they're really, when you get right down to it, there is not a difference other than Laura Loomer, at least you can give her credit for owning the shit that she says, as opposed to Donald Trump, who then just, you know, if he's called out on something, pretends he didn't say it or launches in some counterattack that's irrelevant. So it's like, if you have a problem with Laura Loomer, I mean, if you don't have a problem with Donald Trump, why would you have a problem with Laura Loomer? It was a point that I think both of us have been making. And I think the same thing applies with Mark Robinson and Carrie Lake.
This is right.
And then the guy in Alabama from several years ago, Roy Moore. Right?
Yeah. Although he's like the one Republican who had it held against him that he had multiple allegations from underage girls that he had sort of stalked and engaged in inappropriate.
Although he never walked into, he never was in charge of a beauty pageant and walked into a dressing room to look at the naked women.
I'll tell you the funniest is that I'll go backstage before a show.
Yes.
And everyone's getting dressed and ready and everything else. And, you know, no men are anywhere. And I'm allowed to go in because I'm the owner of the pageant, and therefore I'm inspecting it. You know, I'm inspecting. Right, I want to make sure that
you're like
everything
a doctor.
Is good.
You're there.
Yeah, the dress is everyone okay? You know, they're standing there with no clothes. And so I sort of get away with things like that.
Well, this is the thing about Mark Robinson that I think is, to your point, I guess I can hear it with the voters. Like, I hear the voters make this distinction. And I tend to be less judgmental of voters than I am of sort of the elite folks who absolutely know that there's
no
difference.
Better,
like when you hear people saying, Sam Stein had this great piece about this, you hear people saying, just as you point out, Donald Trump needs to get away from Laura Loomer. I'm like, Donald Trump invented Laura Loomer. Like, he created the world in which the Laura Loomers had a place. She was like 17 years old when he began his first foray into saying that Barack Obama didn't have a birth certificate and couldn't actually be president of the United States, right? So Donald Trump kicked off his political career with a conspiracy theory, right? And so, like, people are like, I can't believe he attracts all these conspiracy theorists.
No,
Donald Trump, as you point out, peeped on women
and
at his
and
shows.
And it's also his choice to have this woman her on the plane. Because everyone, you know, the entire Trump campaign is devoted, as was the Trump White House, to controlling his bizarre and psychotic impulses. And they don't like it when somebody crazier than they gets the guy's ears, because then they have to clean up the mess.
Yes.
And they've been trying to keep Laura Loomer out for many months. I mean, there was one point where he was talking, the New York Times reported that he was thinking of appointing her to a position in the campaign, and then the rest of the campaign leaked it to try to block it. So it's, you know, it's his choice to have the person around. And it was his choice to say that Mark Robinson was like Martin Luther King on steroids and so on and so forth. So that's just a funny thing, because that the Republicans and you're right to talk about the people who know better, right? The Republican elites, they treat Donald Trump as infantile. They treat Donald Trump
no
as
agency.
No agency. Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
That's right.
He's not responsible for January 6th. He just got bad advice from people like Rudy Giuliani and whoever that woman, what's her name?
The Kraken, Sidney Powell.
Yeah, Sidney Powell. He just got bad advice. Okay, but he didn't listen to the actual people who are actual lawyers, like Cipollone's staff, the people in the Justice Department, the people on the campaign, the real lawyers who were telling him, dude, you lost. And none of these, you know, and then the 60, of course, the 60 courts that said, dude, you lost, or denied his claims or whatever. So, you know, I mean, he chooses. It's his choice. It's his decision. And, you know, but he's never, they refuse to hold him morally or intellectually or, you know, responsible for anything that he chooses to do. Right. Yeah.
I think that's really,
it's almost
right.
Like it's a cult or something.
It's almost like it. Here's the other element of this, though, that I want to explore with you just briefly, which is that Mark Robinson would have been absolutely barred from the Republican Party. Like, people would have done, like, he would not have been elected prior to Donald Trump sort of clearing the moral space and creating an appetite. I mean, there was clearly an appetite from enough voters for Trump, so that was pre-existing. But then Donald Trump also did a lot of work to remove. So one of the things that's interesting, right, you just point out Mark Robinson talking about AI and not dropping out. If this stuff had come out for a regular politician 10 years ago, 7 years ago, it'd be over. The party would have been able to get him to drop out. But today, Donald Trump has laid the foundation for you deny, you act like it's no, it's AI, it's not true. And you refuse to back down. You refuse to do the right thing and step aside, right? Donald Trump would never do that. These guys have all learned that lesson.
You know who I feel bad for?
Tell me.
David Duke. He was before his.
Thought you were going to say.
Yeah, no, David Duke. I mean, David Duke really got a raw deal when you think about it. Like he would be a nominee today in Louisiana. You know, he would get the full support of the presidential ticket.
I mean, I don't know how to. Obviously, that sounds preposterous to me as like I listen to it, but also,
yeah.
What evidence do we have that Donald Trump would get somebody due to either racism or other sort of deep moral failings to do anything? Like that he would, he would do nothing. Has done nothing but blaze a path for these folks. And it's not just blaze a path. It is also, and this is where I think it's an interesting, I was doing the Atlantic Festival and the question was like the future of conservatism. And I constantly am trying to impress upon people the fact that we are never going back to the old version of the Republican Party. Right. And one of the reasons that's happening is Donald Trump is, look at all of the people that Donald Trump has created an influx into the party, right? Like there's the Laura Loomers and like the extra political, like the people who are not like in politics, but they are the influencers around Republican politics. But there's also the people who are the elected officials, Matt Gaetz, sex-fueled underage, or like cocaine-fueled sex parties with underage girls.
Oh, yeah, new stuff came out about him this week. It's like, it was no big deal, right? I mean, it was like, oh, my gosh.
Well, it was like, it was too lost. It was too lost in all the rest of the news.
All the other
Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert.
Marjorie Taylor Greene is basically saying Laura Loomer is too much for her.
Too extreme. You know, too extreme.
It's like,
Marjorie Taylor, because she's like right smack in the middle of the party now.
Yeah, no, she's mainstream, holding the center down. I mean, you know, and the funny thing is, I mean, you know, my hope has been for a number of years. I know that this has sort of been a disagreement among people who became anti-Trump or were anti-Trump from the very beginning about, well, what is it that we want, right? We want to retrain, we want to take back the Republican Party. And I remember, I remember probably having this discussion with you or other people. Like, I mean, certainly, is there something left of the Republican Party to recover? And my view has been for a number of years, and I think more people have come over to that view, is that it is irreparable, the damage that has been done to the Republican brand. And I, you know, so one of my hopes is for this election is that the defeat of the Republicans, and not just at the top of the ticket, but downstream. I mean, for example, I live in Maryland. You are too. I live in Maryland, and I have to choose between voting for Angela Alsobrook or former Governor Hogan. And normally I would vote for Hogan, not only because he's a Republican, but he's actually, you know, I may even be a little to the right of him. I don't know. He's actually the kind of Republican that you would want if you were rebuilding the party or building a new conservative party. And I can't vote for him because I feel the need to that the Republican Party has to be completely obliterated so that we can start over. I would not vote for myself if I had an R next to my name. Okay, but the problem is, who's that? Who's going to be in that party?
Who
all these people who aren't the elite, and there include some relatively intelligent people who you have in your focus groups. I mean, they're completely polluted.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to build from, even if the Republican Party falls apart, which I think it may well do. Because, you know, I mean, Trump has merged the RNC into his campaign. And if he loses that campaign, the campaign goes poof and takes the what's left of the RNC with it. And then you have the state parties that are at war with themselves. I mean, what are the building blocks to construct a center-right party, which is something we actually need? And social political scientists will tell you, and common sense will tell you, we need that for functioning two-party democracy. And our system is, because of the first past the post voting and districts and so on, is fundamentally equilibrates at two parties. So where's that? What is that going to, what is that second party going to come from? I have no, at this point, I have no idea.
Yeah. I mean, and this is where I think that the most damaging thing that can happen, right, is that the Republicans are able to, as you point out, hold together a coalition that includes now a majority of people who are the types of people who want Donald Trump affirmatively, want Marjorie Taylor Greene, think that the election was stolen, have been absolutely red-pilled by the right-wing ecosystem or the manosphere or whatever. But then you've got these sort of center-right voters who don't know where to go. And they I always think about them because they're sort of in my persuasion universe. And there are a fair number of them who, for tribal reasons, and because or because they live in sort of a certain kind of media ecosystem or geographic area, they just they like can't figure out how to vote for Democrats. But you got to figure out how to pull enough of those people over yep. to vote for Democrats so that you can deliver sustained electoral defeats
correct.
To the Republicans, which causes them to like at some point the incentive structure changes. The only way they're going to win is by nominating better people and trying to figure out how to have a better voting pool. Like right now, they're trying to appeal to these sort of low propensity voters. And this is going to be it's going to be really interesting when Donald Trump is off the scene.
But to talk, I agree with your incentive point, but I'll qualify it in a certain way. We're getting really into the weeds here. That incentive structure doesn't really function, for example, in for many members of the United States House of Representatives. Because look at if you're Marjorie Taylor Greene,
competitive districts.
You're they're in non-competitive districts, and they don't actually they're not interested in holding power in the House for the purpose of doing what legislators do, which is legislate and figure out policies to make things better. They do it so that they can get on TV, they can get campaign contributions, they can get attention, they can do things on social media. You know, Ted Cruz, okay, he's a senator, but there's a similar dynamic there. He wants to, he's a podcaster. He's not a serious legislator. He never, he's a podcaster.
Yeah, and that's what goes to Cancun when it's cold and the constituents are freezing.
No. And so when you think about the incentive structure, I guess there's an incentive structure for Cruz because he's in a race where actually there was for the first time a poll that showed him down 45-44, morning consult poll. So he actually, the Senate, there is that incentive structure to actually do things to try to have an electoral majority that gets you into office in a general election. Although, you still have the primary problem.
Yeah.
So the dysfunction on the right is so bad. And it's like, the damage that's being done to, you could have a very, very strong conservative views on any number of things. The damage that's being done to the ability to persuade others to at least come some of the distance toward your views is enormous. Because of this sort of entertainment version, this sort of performative version of fake conservatism, like actual conservatives who believe in policies and who are, whether or not they're pro-Trump because of they thought that was the best way to do it or not. It's not, this isn't a never Trumper thing, but I'm thinking, I'm thinking of a guy like, some of these dispatch people, right? You're never going to get anything good out of the political system that you agree with, or at least a partially agree with, if you allow this performative bullshit to continue. Example, again, immigration policy. Because it was all, because it was all performative and all designed to affect the electoral prospects of one selfish, narcissistic nut job. We don't have an immigration reform bill that by any standard would have been an absolute victory for the right.
Yeah. I totally agree with this. I actually made this point on the stage at the Atlantic too, which is if you're George W. Bush or you're the generals, so you're anybody who wants the Republican Party back. Like, I obviously I don't think it can come back in the kind of form that people want it, but if you want a shot at trying to build something better or functioning as a governing body, you better hope Trump loses. And you know what, George? You know what we know? We know they do want Trump to lose.
They do, they just, but they won't. They won't
do anything about it, though.
Correct. They all want Trump to lose. Even people at the RNC want Trump to lose.
100%.
Okay? I'm sure people who are being paid on the payroll, although, you know, they're conflicted because they want to whatever stream of money they can get out of the Republican Party and Trump they want to keep. But they realize that the long-term play here isn't great. No, there are so many. Anyway,
I was on CNN the other day, and your buddy, who you've gotten into it with before, Scott Jennings, and this is not meant to, this is not for us to pile on Scott, because actually I walked into the green room and I saw him and I was like, oh, Scott, it is too early in the morning for me to fight with you. It's like 6 a.m. or like 5:30 in the morning.
Did you say that to him?
Yeah, I did.
And what did he say?
Well, you know, because I knew, he just kind of laughed. He was like, he was in a bad place because Scott the whole thing with Mark Robinson, it just happened. He knew we were going to talk about it. Like being a Trump surrogate is a lousy gig, right?
It's a lousy gig. I don't know why anybody bothers to do it.
And I don't know that I wasn't going to jump all over him over that unless he defended
it. Until he says something.
But then this is what I want to ask you about. Okay. So in the next block, we were talking about Trump going to this anti-Semitic, it was a conference on anti-Semitism, combating anti-Semitism. He goes on to be like,
well, at least it was on topic.
Well, he was like, Trump's thing is, if it'll be Jewish people's fault if I lose. And he's like, right. I don't
blame the Jews. Anti-Semitism. It was an anti-Semitism conference. So yeah, blame the Jews. At least it was sort of on topic, I guess.
And he's saying, you know, a Jewish person that votes for Kamala Harris.
I thought it was anti-Semitism, but he made it a pro-anti-Semitism conference, I guess.
So Scott, like, does a normal kind of move of, like, Trump's just out there trying to win over the Jewish vote. You know, he's good. He should go fight for the Jewish vote. And I was like, okay. Saying any Jewish person who votes for Kamala Harris should have their head examined.
His head examined. He said that before.
I feel like this isn't the best way to go about it, but okay, whatever.
The problem
I had is when Scott Jennings then leaned across the table and said, we all know that the problem of anti-Semitism is on the left.
And everybody sitting at this table knows where the source of anti-Semitism is in this country. It is not on the right.
And started to kind of be like, and you, they're your people now. You'll defend them. Which, I mean, he's either listened to nothing I've ever said since we spent during the campus protests. I was not a big fan of a lot of what I was hearing. And I would say that the Bulwark, pretty staunch ally of Israel, although also recognizing that, we should care about civilians dying.
Whether or not they're Palestinian or Jewish or whatever. Yeah, absolutely. And we want war to end, but we also want peace and we want no terrorism. I don't know if that, you know, that's hard to achieve, impossible maybe for now, but those are the objects. And I don't think, you know, I don't think it's hard to explain what it is we kind of want.
It is not. And also, like, I when I see people who are get a little wiggly on whether or not you can just like outright condemn Hamas, it is easy to outright condemn terrorism.
Right. What to do about Hamas? It gets tricky because that's certain, you know, because they hide behind civilians and they burrow under hospitals and schools and they're funded. They have seemed to have, like, you know, the more bad things to do, the more they're funded by bad people elsewhere. I mean, you know, it's a problem.
It's a problem that I think defies just like little convenient sound bites. But the part I really take issue with from Scott, if you want to say that anti-Semitism is on the rise and it's got bipartisan roots, you get no pushback from me. No complaints.
Absolutely.
Like, we got a problem in this country. And since October 7th, anti-Semitism has been on the rise. He leans across the table and he says, it is on the left, like only on the left. Like the left is doing this. And And what I, and so I this is I did get angrier than I would have liked.
Did Trump dine with Nick Fuentes? Is Nick Fuentes a right white supremacist?
He did dine with Nick Fuentes.
Is he a white supremacist?
He should not have done that.
Yeah.
He should not have done that.
Okay, great. Okay, so now we know that it is not only a.
So you're saying one person who got invited to a stupid dinner versus the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of progressive activists in the streets, that's the equivocation?
That's an insane equivocation for you. These college kids who are wrong. I have denounced those.
Well, that's your party now. Those are your people. Huh? Those are the people you seek to represent.
Yeah, because I would never belong to a party.
That's your coalition. That's your coalition.
Donald Trump had dinner at Mar-a-Lago with Nick Fuentes, a self-described white supremacist. Yep. Kanye West, who was at the height of his anti-Semitism at the time. I haven't seen Kanye in a while. Don't come back. We don't need you. And then we've also got Marjorie Jewish Space Lasers, Taylor Greene, who's been out there. We've got this black Nazi guy who we had just been talking about. Yeah. We have Charlottesville. We have, let's see. I mean, it can go on and on. And so if you want to say Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, to me, you go right ahead and I'll tell you, let's go primary them. I loved seeing Cori Bush get primaried. I love seeing Jamal Bowman get primaried. Yep. And they lost. Let's go get don't tell me.
No, the Democrats are cleaning up their own, are cleaning up after them, on their side as much as they can.
That's right. So Kamala Harris is married to a Jewish man, but we are being told, we are being gaslit. So I pressed.
Yeah, by saying that Kamala Harris doesn't like
Donald
Jews,
Trump.
Like the one who. No, it's crazy.
Yeah, so I press Scott. Did Donald Trump dine with Nick Fuentes? Yes. Is Nick Fuentes a white supremacist?
You should be a lawyer.
Oh,
you say you're not a lawyer.
Oh, okay.
But you should be a lawyer. That's good cross-examination.
So then let me tell you what this guy does. He puts out a video. He puts out a video where he has cut out the part where he's forced to admit about Donald Trump and having dinner with Nick Fuentes at Mar-a-Lago.
You cannot deny what we have seen in America since October the 7th, and it has only to do with one thing. Anti-Semitism is on the rise, and there are people who feel like now is the time to let it out, and it is ugly.
Marjorie, Jewish.
You're making a tactical argument, and everybody sitting at this table knows where the source of anti-Semitism is in this country. It is not on the right. So you're saying one person who got invited to a stupid.
And then he puts it out like only he was talking, and everybody else just sat there. I thought that was one of the most dishonest. It's one thing if you want to put it out in its entirety and be like, I defended my position. I believe in my position. But to cut out the part where you were forced to admit your wrongness.
Well, I actually
not great.
I think about it, I mean, one of the things I had my run in with Scott Jennings, it was the morning after the guilty verdict in the Trump trial in New York. And he said some utter bullshit about the charges and about the jury charge. I mean, he knows nothing about the law, and he was just making false statements. And I basically called him out for it.
Scott's lying, and that's the problem with the Republican Party. It is continually addicted to lies.
You're lying about the law.
You're lying about what the jury was charged to find. They don't have to find an underlying crime. They had to find the intent to cover up an underlying crime. And the underlying crime was pretty obvious.
What was the crime?
You ran for public office, Scott. You ran for public office, Scott. You know you can't take money from somebody and reimburse them if it's a campaign expense.
I've never run for public office.
And okay, fine. Well, you're close enough. You're involved in politics to know that, okay? So that's the problem with the Republican Party, is that they are suffused with lies. I don't know why this network is paying Scott to say those lies.
Let's not go there, George, please.
And I basically said, I cannot believe that this network is paying you to say these lies, which then Casey Hunt said, he's a colleague, we can't say that, blah, blah, blah. This should get him in trouble with CNN, actually. He's republishing CNN video of their program, and he's doing it misleadingly, and he's on their payroll. It would seem to me that that would be something, if I were running a network, I would say, okay, you know, you're free to post clips of yourself online that, you know, of your appearances on CNN, but you can't do it misleadingly because it reflects poorly on us. I mean, he should be in trouble with CNN.
I mean, I don't know. I just want to call him out for it because there's also.
You did a great job calling him out.
I also, Daily Wire then put out his doctored video, the thing that's cut out. And I was like, and said like, good job to Scott Jennings. Like, look at the panel. They don't even know what to say. And I was like, oh, I knew exactly what to say. I said it. He just cut it out. Number one. Number two, the Daily Wire, really? The people who platformed Candace Owens, one of the most high profile anti-Semites on the right? You're going to try to take the moral high ground on this?
No,
I got to say, George, it might be because we're getting close to the election and things are hot. But I'm not sure that I can't hold back my contempt for the gaslighting from some of these folks.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I've lost any patience that I have for any of it. I mean, which is why I went off on Scott Jennings that morning in May or June or whenever it was. I'm not tolerating it. And I commend you for, this wasn't the only time you've had a run-in with him in the last week or so, and the only time you've called him out on social media and on air in the last week or so. But I commend you for your service.
Well, I appreciate it. I think there was a different Trump surrogate that was on one day when I was Tapper.
Well, they're all like, right. Oh, yeah. Who was like that? There was a woman who was really just ridiculous. Who was she? I've never seen her before.
Yeah, her name's Michaela. You know who she was? What's his name? Kevin McCarthy's chief of. Yeah, I don't know if he's legal counsel. She worked for Kevin McCarthy. This was a similar thing where it was just I like the extent to which she was trying to have a normal sort of policy conversation, but we're talking about Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who made the statement, my children keep me humble.
Keep me humble.
And then says Kamala Harris has nothing keeping her humble. Just like, it's like the stupidest thing to go after someone for, but they're going after Kamala Harris for not having biological children. And so Michaela was sort of doing a like, I'm not sure that's what she meant. And I was like, there's really no other way to interpret that. And also, the extent of the viciousness of the Trump campaign with what's happening in Springfield right now, the extent to which they are lying about the Haitian immigrants eating dogs and cats, which is it's like one of those things where like it's preposterous, it's stupid, it's silly, you can make jokes about it. Right. On the other hand, there were 33 bomb threats as of Wednesday of last week. Yeah. These kids are not able to go to school. Yeah. People are being terrorized. And all these people, Donald Trump and J.D. Vance are telling these lies.
Right. They came to America and they ended up in Springfield, Ohio, because there were jobs there and they work hard and they're trying to, they're trying to get their kids educated. And this is what they get. It's obscene. And it's all been perpetrated by their own United States senator.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
That's right. And it's like you've got the governor, the Republican governor of the state. You've got the Republican, mayor of the town all saying this isn't happening. And in fact, in case our audience missed this, because there was so much news this week, I just want to highlight this. The Wall Street Journal did a great piece asking if they basically reported that the Trump and J.D. Vance team had reached out to the Springfield mayor, the Springfield officials, and said, is this happening? They were told, no, it is not happening. And it was before the debate. They were told that the day before Trump debated or the day of the debate. And he still repeated it.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
They knew it was a lie.
Right. And he said, didn't he tell Dana Bash? Like, if I have to create stories in order to illustrate my points, I'll do that.
These are bad. This goes back to being in.
These are bad people.
Bad people.
I, I,
Nobody's perfect. Okay. We'll all stipulate nobody's perfect. Everybody's got things that they do that are wrong, whatever. That's different from knowing. Like the people, like the one of the women who had filed a report saying her cat had gone missing and she thought it was the Haitians who stole them. She found her cat. She found her cat in the basement. So she apologized to the Haitians in her community. She apologized to her neighbors and she apologized publicly. The woman who put the original Facebook post out, who said, who made it like, who like heard a rumor and put it online and it went, she apologized. Yeah. They're sorry. They're sorry. They're doing this to their own community.
Yeah.
That's what you do. Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, they're not saying sorry. Right. They're doubling down.
So J.D. Vance does not care about his own constituents.
And it really is despicable. All right, George. I'm going to do one more ad, and then we're going to get to a little bit of legal news. I do want to ask you, just really quickly, Jody Kantor and Adam Liptak had a piece in the New York Times this week with some behind-the-scenes reporting on what has been going on at the Supreme Court during all these Trump cases. And it's really long, in-depth reporting, so we don't need to go into the weeds, but a few things stood out. One of them, to me, like the one thing that was clear to me is that there is a lot of leaking going on at the Supreme Court these days, which I gather is weird and unusual.
It is weird and unusual, and it's disturbing. I think it really undermines the court. I think it undermines the ability of the court to function because, I mean, one of the things you want to have in order to be able to you know, you want to have internal discussions about cases and issues that are before the court in a manner that, you know, where you don't end up having your internal discussions in the newspaper. To an extent, this has happened in the past with books, you know, like The Brethren. And there was also a book by Jan, whose last name I forget, Jan Greenberg. Crawford Greenberg, the stuff does get out over time, and then there is, you know, Blackmun's papers were released in the Library of Congress. But to have this happen in almost real time, and real time in the case of that leak of the Dobbs opinion, is just, you know, it is so destructive of the internal processes of the court and the collegiality that is necessary to have a functioning court that it's just very disturbing. It's just illustrative that something is very wrong at the court.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my takeaway is that there just must be so much hostility like that. They have to confirm some of these leaks, which means people are either they have multiple people doing it, they have people, and I wonder if there's like reciprocal leaks now, like there's, and I can't tell, is it people who are mad at, like, is it young conservatives on the court who are mad at the way these justices are behaving? I can't begin to understand what it is, but it does feel like further erosion in just.
Yeah, I know. They conducted a whole investigation, I think, using the Supreme Court police or somebody, of the leak of the Dobbs opinion, which ended up being relatively close to what the final opinion was.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's impossible to figure out who did it. And you can think of motives for any number of people. You know, you can think that the liberals did it in order to put pressure on liberal clerks, or maybe not. I doubt that justice really would do this, but people would to try to basically put pressure on the court not to issue the decision. Or you could just say, or some people, a lot of people believe that some conservatives did it in order to lock in the votes that they had. I mean, who knows? I mean, you can just posit all sorts of motives. I mean, the whole thing is just terrible for the atmosphere of the court. It just creates a level of mistrust, and when what you need is collegiality, even if you have disagreements on very, very important cases, which the court has always had. I mean, the notion that you can say something to a colleague on one day and the next day it could be in the newspaper or the next week or the next month or within a few months is it is so destructive of the processes and of the way that a court like that needs to function that I don't know what to do about it, but something has to be done about it.
And, you know, last week we talked about whether judges should consider or acknowledge the political context when they're making decisions. And the Times reporting shows that the court definitely, like the Supreme Court, is definitely taking into account the political context of these decisions. Like both Thomas and Gorsuch wanted the immunity case pushed back past the election. So there's this guy, Steve Vladek, and he wrote in his newsletter this week about the Times reporting that, so this is Vladek speaking, this is a court that is well aware of the political storm surrounding it, and in some cases for which it is responsible, and is not simply pulling in its oars. No one in Cantor and Liptak's reporting is arguing for even a modicum of judicial restraint, and none of the justices to the right of Justice Barrett seem at all worried about the institutional impact of continuing to divide so transparently along partisan and ideological lines in the court's highest profile and themselves politically charged rulings. And I was wondering if you agreed with that, because I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I do agree with Steve. I think Steve is a very, you know, we disagree, Steve and I disagree on a lot of issues, but I do agree with him about these process issues and the collegiality question. I mean, there is always going to be some politics that kind of seeps into the court. I mean, the Supreme Court does things that have impact in the political world. And, you know, the way that the court has historically dealt with that was talked about in an interesting book written by Alexander Bickel, who was then considered to be a conservative legal scholar in the 60s and 70s at Yale Law School. And he wrote a book called The Least Dangerous Branch. And one of the things he said, and he was really doing it in the context of Brown v. Board of Education and then the progeny and the school desegregation cases. And he was talking about how, you know, the court can avoid getting into the political realm by deferring taking on issues because it has the discretionary power to deny certiorari and not take a case and not, you know, and pace itself in making decisions that might create political controversy. And that has always been sort of an interesting notion that the court may take into politics by using its discretion. But the problem is the problem with that is if you overgame it, like the way the Supreme Court seems to be overgaming things, or at least some justices seem to be overgaming things and trying to, and trying to think about the political ramifications of what it's doing at any given moment and the timing of it. First of all, it really undermines and if it gets out the way it has in the Liptak piece, it undermines. It defeats the whole purpose of the court trying to stay out of politics and trying to leaven the impact of its decisions on the judicial process. And the other thing about it is these judges are bad politicians. They're not good at judging the political consequences of their decisions or failure to decide things. I mean, that is clear. Okay.
That is clear.
That you would not want any of these guys running a political campaign, because they would run it into the ground.
Okay, you hear that, terrible. Alito?
Yeah, terrible. They're terrible at politics. Which is fine, because they shouldn't be doing politics. But they should be sticking to their knitting, which is basically deciding issues. And as I said before, and like we talked about this in the context of the immunity decision and other decisions, and I've actually, I've compared the immunity decision to Roe. We had a whole discussion about that a couple months ago. They need to basically not think of themselves as gods on a mountain trying to decide all issues relating to a certain case for all time, but decide things narrowly, one case at a time, so that they aren't embroiling themselves in unnecessary controversy, and so that they don't make the mistakes that you make when you try to foresee all the possibilities of facts that might come to in a future case, when all your job is to do is to decide this set of facts and the law that applies to this set of facts. And then what they did in the immunity decision, as I probably spent two episodes of our podcast saying, is that they were trying to foresee all the crazy circumstances in the future and try to, you know, try to weigh all the possibilities, when all they needed to do to decide this one case is whether President of the United States could commit crimes to stay in office beyond his time and, you know, and wage an insurrection in connection therewith, which shouldn't be that hard. But they made it hard. And they undermined the court in making it hard and trying to decide future cases, like, you know, the SEAL Team 6 case.
Yep. Well, the Supreme Court's got some work to do. Okay.
Yeah.
We've got a little work to do, too, because we got some listener questions I want to get to. Our first question is from Scott. Why can't someone at DOJ who unquestionably meets the standard of a federal officer or the U.S. attorney from the Southern District of Florida call Judge Cannon's bluff and refile the case instead of wasting time on an appeal?
I think, you know, there are a couple of answers to that. The principal, I mean, this was actually, that's a very good listener, viewer question.
Our listeners are smart.
No, they really are. And I've run into them on the street, and they really are smart. Randall Eliason, a professor at Georgetown here, or was it George Washington? He's a law professor here in town, made that suggestion. And I disagree with it because I think there's a good chance that if the case is refiled, it would get sent back to her as a related case. You know, one of the things that happens is if a judge decides case A and then another case presenting similar facts and issues involving similar parties is filed, you check a box on the cover sheet that you file with the complaint, and you have to identify the prior case. And what often happens, and I think this happens in the Southern District of Florida, is the case gets sent to the judge who had the prior case, because it's efficient to do that in the normal circumstance. It's efficient to send a similar case to the prior judge that had the similar case, a similar case, because it's more efficient than that. The judge doesn't have to reread the cases. The judge is familiar with the background factually, if there's a factual overlap. And I don't know that this case wouldn't have gotten assigned if it were refiled. I don't know that it would not have gotten assigned to Judge Cannon. And so you'd be back in the soup again.
That makes sense. Good question, Scott. Okay, question from Deborah. Last week, you discussed potential changes to the Supreme Court, including term limits. I noticed that Sarah strongly believes that lifelong appointments rules should not change. I don't know about that. When Hamilton wrote the Federalist Papers, the average life expectancy in the Americas was about 40 years. Today it is around 77 years or so. Don't you think it's time to modernize these rules to fit the current era by limiting the length of their appointments? I'll just say for myself really quickly, I am just, it's not that I am so strongly against it. I think there could be a way to do term limits that is useful, but I also don't love messing with our institutions without a really well thought through plan. And I don't like doing it simply because we don't like the current makeup of the court. I think if there's a change to be made that sort of is a benefit to everyone, and term limits could be, you know, I'm interested in thinking it through. I just wouldn't say that I'm like reflexively for it.
And I, you know, even though I'm a little bit more in favor of reform than you are, I agree with everything you just said. And I also, if we are talking about term limits, those are unconstitutional. You cannot limit the terms of a Supreme Court justice. And, you know, and there's no way the Constitution is ever going to be amended, frankly, for anything at this point in our nation's history. And I wouldn't want to mess with the Constitution. That said, there may be a way to restructure the court in a manner that where not all of the justices sit, and you have the youngest justices basically consist ordinarily making up the panel of nine people who hear any given case, except when there are recusals, you could swap one of the older justices in. I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that would prevent that from happening. And that would also allow, I confess I have not read the Biden proposal carefully or closely, but that would permit the appointment of additional justices and would depoliticize the confirmation process, because every couple of years you get a new, you know, it's not some kind of a thing where somebody gets to age 90 and all of a sudden you have to appoint another one, and you might get some judge, some president might get two in a row or three, and the court gets, you know, tipped one way or the other, and it's very political. This I think would reduce the pressure on that process. But again, I agree with you. It's got to be really, really well thought out. And, you know, my worry is that Congress isn't capable of thinking things out well.
Yeah, I do wonder. I mean, if we got to a point where we could reach some kind of bipartisan, I mean, we do have an issue. And this point about just longevity, I think, is a good one.
It is a good one.
Because I think that both when it comes to our legislators, our presidents and our presidential candidates, like, we have this thing now where we've had a lot of people in their late 70s and 80s who are continuing to pursue their
political. Yeah, I mean, you could have, you know, you appoint somebody at age 42 and they could be there till age 86.
Yeah.
I mean, that's crazy. That is absolutely crazy.
And but also I think that this idea of like people like the way that RBG was hanging on, you know, like that is not a good way to run a court. And to have people, you know, I know everybody, we were all psyched she could do a plank for such a long time. And, but like, she 90, or 86. I mean, she was very elderly, at the time. And it's not good. That's not good for any of our institutions.
And I'll throw something else out here. This is utter speculation. And I normally don't like to engage in it because I don't like to question the good faith of justices or judges, even when I have questions. There are people who suggest that one of the things that was motivating some of the justices on the Supreme Court in connection with these Trump cases was the desire to have someone other than President Biden, or now President Harris, I guess, appoint their successors. Mm-hmm. And that's really that, if that's true, if that was any part of motivation of any of these individuals, the older ones in particular that I'm thinking of that I won't name,
Judge Thomas.
That's really disturbing.
Yeah.
That's really, really disturbing. And that is an argument for reform.
Yes. I think
that sort of dovetails with the, you know, I mean, it's sort of a different problem than the RBG problem, but the reform that is being suggested, I think, would alleviate those problems.
Yeah, I think that maintaining what is a lifetime appointment, but also, and I don't know if you change this constitutionally or if Congress could pass a bill that says, like, we're going to start considering lifetime to like end at 78 when it comes to the job. Like, your life doesn't end, but the lifetime sort of means 78 is the cap on that. Or so, like, I do think that there are things that we could do that are fair, that are equal, and that solve some of these problems. Anyway, that was a good couple good questions.
Constitution, that's a little constitution. There's some tricky. It's tricky constitutionally, though.
Yeah. Okay, George. As always, thank you for taking the time to talk about the legal news with me. And thanks to all of you for joining us. Don't forget to hit subscribe, leave us a review, email us at askgeorge@thebulwark.com. And we will see you guys next week. Bye.
Hey, Sarah, have you heard the news? Trump's got the legal blues. 34 charges stacked up high. Hush money scheme didn't fly. The news is all over town. George is here to break it down. George Conway explains it all. Trump's troubles big and small. From Mar-a-Lago to D.C., he'll make sense of it for you and me. Jack Smith's on a mission now, January 6th under the lens. Classified docs and bathroom stalls, Trump wasn't so smart after all. George is ready with the facts, breaking down every crooked act. George Conway explains it all, Trump's troubles big and small. From Mar-a-Lago to D.C., he'll make sense of it for you and me. Courtrooms, the Twitter feeds, George breaks down what everyone needs. Sarah's got questions, we're dying to know about subpoenas and quid pro quo. Conway's got answers clear and true, Trump's legal maze, he'll guide us through. George Conway explains it all, Trump's troubles big and small. From Mar-a-Lago to D.C., he'll make sense of it for you and me. George Conway explains it all, Trump's troubles big and small. From Mar-a-Lago to D.C., he'll make sense of it for you and me.